This Week in Radio Tech is sponsored by Axia Audio. Axia, maker of the PowerStation IP audio console. Yes, it's powerful. On the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
You know, you got to go buy the 2-liter bottle of beer so you can have the bottle to put over the spark gaps.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And on this show, it's Chris Tarr, Tom Ray with great stories, and a special appearance by Scott Feibusch, Mr. Tower Calendar.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. We're glad that you have tuned in. Thanks for downloading the podcast or tuning in live on the Twit Network. Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host for the show. Very glad that you're here. This is a show where we talk about radio technology, anything from the stylus to the CD player to automation, IP audio. We talk about audio consoles and processing and microwaves and getting the signal to the tower and getting the signal from the tower out to the listeners and everything in between. Sometimes we talk about fixing the toilet too, because occasionally the engineer is charged with doing that. If you're a broadcast engineer, welcome in. If you're not, well, stay away. Don't do it, really. Don't step in. Water's cold. On the show are a couple of usual co-hosts and a guest. Glad to have the guest with us. Let's go ahead and introduce our guest first. How about that? We'll change it up a bit. Our guest is Scott Feibusch from Northeast Radio Watch. Hey, Scott.
Hi there.
Glad you're with us. You've been a guest on the show before, and you're here to talk about radio station projects and towers and a cool Christmas gift.
Yes, indeed.
Well, yes, we're looking
indeed.
Forward
tower
to
tower site calendar.
Yeah, yeah.
Show that for our video friends. There it is right there.
We'll get it out of the way. We'll mention it again. What's a website people could go to find out more about Scott and, of course, see the calendar?
That would be www.feibusch.com, F-Y-B-U-S-H, and calendar link is right there on the front page.
Cool. Well, stand by, Scott. We're going to have you tell us about some interesting tower projects. Let's bring in our other co-hosts, and one of them is Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley of New York. Hey, Tom.
Hey, greetings, Kirk. Good evening to you, and for those not watching on video, I am sitting here wearing my official Santa hat that says Bah Humbug.
You're so cute, Tom. You're so cute.
Are you in your ham shack? I'm adorable.
are you in your ham shack?
Yes. I'm sitting in my ham shack, and I'm in a humbug mood tonight. So, near the end of the show, I do have a plug for my ham radio club, because it's something some people listening may want to get involved in with us this weekend.
All right, good. And also with us from the frozen upper Midwest, it's Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin.
You got it! Hooray!
All right.
Awesome. We are here in the frozen tundra. It is. I'm looking at my little weather bug thing. It's 10 degrees right now in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, 10. God bless you, Chris.
Yeah. And I'm not plugging anything tonight. I've got nothing to sell other than my, you know, sparkling personality.
So Chris, you probably have a beer on the porch getting cold. Is that how y'all do it there?
It's Wisconsin. You can't walk anywhere without tripping over beer. What are you saying?
I've got
a huge keg sitting on the back porch. You know, actually, Wisconsin, we've got the kegerators, which are the refrigerators with the tappers built into the side.
Do you need a refrigerator with 10 degrees?
Well, no, you got a good point there, but usually the problem is a beer freezes and it explodes if you do that. And then I think in Wisconsin. I think in Wisconsin, that's a class X felony or something if you let that happen.
I was going to ask you, at what temperature does beer freeze?
I don't know. I've never let it happen.
Okay. Oh, golly. Hey, any topical news to talk about? We had some requests from people on Twitter and in the chat room for a few subjects, and we'll cover some of these upcoming. I appreciate the feedback on Twitter. But one of the subjects was to talk about towers and antenna systems. So that'll be a good topic for tonight. And guys, we did very little prep here. We spent all the pre-show just yapping about stuff that maybe doesn't matter. Or maybe the stuff we talk about doesn't matter. Tom, hey, Tom, you've been gone for a couple of weeks. What's been on your agenda? What have you been doing lately?
Oh, Lordy. Well, let's see. Last week, we had a big remote at WOR, but before that, that was on Thursday. On Wednesday afternoon, I was at a luncheon and got a phone call from Master Control with the four words you never want to hear as a broadcast engineer. We are off the air.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the FCC is here.
No, the FCC doesn't bother me. We're off the air does.
All right.
Hey, for those not familiar with AM antenna systems, you usually have a little shack down near the bottom of the tower. It's called a tuning house. That's where the tuning components are. And yeah, you have usually a copper pipe that connects the tuning house to the tower. It's got a curly Q in it. What the curly Q is for is to retard lightning. And anyway, in our case, it's a 1-inch copper pipe, and it goes between the tuning house and the tower. And we had extremely high winds on Wednesday, and it caught this curly Q at tower 2 just right, and it kind of snapped off the tower.
A piece of copper?
It snapped it right off the tower.
It must have vibrated and gotten the copper weak.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing, and of course it was raining like all get out. We go out there, we find this, and actually it was quite funny because we were on reduced power. We get out there, I brought it up to 50 kilowatts, and it sat there and ran. I was like, "That's unique." Well, there's a sample line for a sample loop on the tower that we don't use, and it's only used for testing, and there's reasons for that I won't get into here, but. That little 3/8-inch line was taking 20 kilowatts, and it's now a crispy critter. But
the 3/8-inch sample line on your AM directional was carrying the normal the AM power normally carried by the copper the curly Q copper pipe, right?
Right, right. And a 3/8-inch line is not rated at 20 kilowatts, so we. Luckily we had it on low power till extremely reduced power till we got there. And then when we got there, I brought it up to 50 to see what would happen. And the thing came up and looked at me and said, "Hi, I'm fine." It was like, what? Something that took us down. That's when we went out to the tower and we found this. So it's raining like a mother. We wrapped an electric drill in several garbage bags. Went out there with a wire brush attachment. Had to wire brush everything, drill out the bolt, put everything back together, snug it down nice. Went back in the building, brought it back up on directional, brought it up to 50 kilowatts. It sat there and ran. 15 minutes later, it was sitting there like a rock. I said, "Okay, our job is done." We walked out the door and the sun was out. Thank you. And there was no indication when we were doing the work that the sun was going to come out.
Aren't the WOR towers pretty new, so weren't you a little surprised that the wind caught this thing just right? And it sounds like that's something that would happen to an old piece of copper.
Well, I was surprised, but this is the array is 5 years old, and this thing's been sitting there, and believe it or not, it does get very windy out in the Meadowlands, especially this time of year. So yeah, I was surprised, but it didn't surprise me that we'd have an issue at some point, and it just happened to be now. Then the next day, we had a big remote for the Salvation Army. We did a combination radiothon telethon with Channel 4 Television here in New York over at 30 Rock. We set up in one side of the NBC Experience Cafe. They set up on the other side in this on this one portion on the floor. And we proceeded to raise $425,000 for the Salvation Army on a 12-hour remote on last Thursday.
You were telling you were telling me about the tree in Rockefeller Center, and maybe you saw it at a time that most people don't see it?
Well, actually, I saw it twice at a time when most people don't see it. One was when I showed up at 2:30 in the morning to begin setup for the remote, and they actually pulled the plug on the thing overnight. Most people probably don't realize that. It makes sense. There's really nobody around, but in the city that never sleeps, you wouldn't think they'd do that. But I walked up there. The tree was dark. The time I saw it before that was before the tree lighting, which was last Tuesday. And we went up to test out some of our wireless mics on the plaza to see where we might have some problems. And So we set up inside this window in the NBC Experience Cafe with the wireless mics, and I said to Anthony, our remote guy, because we're looking at the tree. I mean, we're sitting there. We're staring at the tree. I mean, there it is out the window. And it was covered with scaffolding. They were putting the lights on, and I said to him, you know, this is probably an artificial tree. They're just putting the branches on. So we chuckled over that. And then we went out to, we set things up with an IFB so we could hear the mics, and we went for a walk on the plaza. And as we come around the other side of the tree, of course, they trim these branches off the bottom. There they are with the branches, and they're hauling them up, and they're sticking them in the tree to fill it in so there are no bare or spots that just don't look right. So gotcha. Anthony and I had a good laugh over that, because here I am talking about they're sticking the branches in the artificial tree, and lo and behold, they're sticking branches in the tree.
Yeah, and when you were looking at them put the tree together, I got to ask, were there any cell tower antennas up in the tree?
You know, we were looking for that. We didn't see any. But the funniest cell phone tree I've seen recently had an addition to it. The tree itself didn't look bad. What looked bad was the fact that they took the additional antennas and stuck them about, this far outside of the tree area and painted them bright green.
So there they were, just sticking out like sore thumbs.
Oh, you bet. And you know, the thing that really makes me sad about the whole remote is I was so busy I didn't get a chance to moon the Today Show.
We're all thankful for that.
Oh,
and on that cue, we ought to check in with Mr. Tarr. Hey, we really appreciate that live remote broadcast you did from the transmitter site last week, Chris. That was just uber cool. I hope you get a chance to do it again. Maybe when everything's...
Yeah, transmitters are always breaking. So, it was just kind of funny because just as always, you know, it always happens when you least expect it. We had that happen, and I was thinking, it's like, wow, it's Wednesday, I've got TWRT. And you sent out the email, and I was actually in the car driving out there. And it just kind of struck me like, well, you know, I could stop what I'm doing for a couple of minutes and show you around. And it just so happens that literally about 3 minutes before my time when TWRT starts, which is 7 o'clock Central, just a couple of minutes before that, we were able to get the transmitter back on and running. And so the timing was just perfect. So we were able to wrap it up and get everything put together. And so, you know, and for those of you who are wondering who saw last week, the transmitter has worked fine. We replaced the resistor there that had the issue. And the exciter, we were unable to get fixed. We tested it after we got off the air, or after we've wrapped up with TWRT here. And no go. So it's back at, send it back to Continental to get repaired. But the transmitter itself has been great since we effected that repair. So we've had no problems since then. I have had a few other issues. My AM array I had to deal with the other day. Transmitter kept going on, popping on and off the air. Usually a sign that something's wrong with one of the towers, you know, load change or something like that. So I went out to the tower, and what we have, I've mentioned this before, in between the spark ball gaps to kind of keep critters out and keep it clear, we put in soda bottles over the spark gaps. Well, apparently that tower at one point recently took a nice, good lightning hit and shrunk the bottle and charred it. It was actually, it started on fire. There was burnt plastic all over the place. And the reason it was tripping off was there's debris that had fallen in between the ball gap. So I went out there and cleaned that off and got everything back to normal and put everything back on the air. So now I've got to go drink another 2-liter bottle of soda so I get another bottle to put out over the spark gap there. So see, if they made beer in 2-liter bottles, we'd be all set. But, you know, we just, no beer in 2-liter bottles.
Anyway, I thought that was Wisconsin. I thought you did everything with beer.
No, everything goes better with beer. But that doesn't necessarily mean, you know. Although I am surprised. I'm thinking maybe we need to come up with 2-liter beer bottles. I'm thinking
there's the same
thing. Yeah, I might be onto something here. You know, and not only that, but we'd have a bunch of AM transmitter engineers, I think, would be very happy. You know, I got to go, because it's a work expense then. You know, you've got to go buy the 2-liter bottle of beer so you can have the bottle to put over the spark gaps.
Jeez. Oh, hey, I want to bring Scott Feibusch into this. Scott, you have been to plenty of AM transmitter sites yourself. Think a bit about AM transmitter sites that have something goofy going on at the base of the tower. And actually, I'll start here because I may have mentioned this before on the show, but here in Nashville at WSM, their tower, which is one of these diamond shaped Blaw Knox towers, they've got enormous spark gap at the base of the tower. It's two steel balls. One is attached to the tower. The other is attached to ground. And of course, there's insulation or the insulators, holding the tower up above ground. It's a series fed tower. So the tower itself is insulated and it's hot. And in the summertime, they mount a hairdryer to another stick there near the ball gaps, and they blow air between the ball gaps all summer long. And of course, I had to ask at the time. The engineer was Watt Hairston. I said, "Watt, what's the deal with the blow dryer and the ball gaps? Is it to keep them dry?" He says, "No, it's actually just to keep the gnats away from them. For some reason, the gnats are attracted to that area, and." When there's gets too many of them, then it actually reduces the breakdown voltage across the ball gap, and it can arc over, and the transmitter seems to sustain that arc just fine. And so anyway, they blow air across it. So that's my little story. Scott, AM transmitter sites, tell us about something that you've seen that's a little odd. Oh, Scott's not there. Did he drop off? Scott, when he gets back, is going to talk to us about a project in Rochester, New York, where they've actually been taking down a 30-year-old big candelabra tower and the UHF antennas associated with that. Hey, Tom, out at your AM transmitter site, you had that problem with the antenna feed, copper pipe curlicue.
Yes, sir.
Since the towers are new, I wouldn't expect much to be going wrong. What else has gone wrong there in the 5 years since the towers were new?
Let's see. We had... I'm going to say what, about 3 months after the towers went up, the newer towers have what's called a safety climb for the tower climbers. And what it is, it's a steel cable that goes top to bottom, almost to the bottom. And they can tie onto that. So, if they, God forbid, they slip or something goes wrong, they're not going to, come crashing to the ground. They'll stop in a real hurry. But it allows them to climb somewhat freely. So they, I got a call. I was actually out at our California stations and I got a call at 2 a.m. Pacific time. Thank you very much. After getting to bed at midnight and, we're off the air. Well, we managed to flip the thing over and get it over onto non-directional. And I called one of my other engineers and said, go out there. So he went out, looked at towers 2 and 3, didn't see anything wrong, goes out to tower 1. He says, what's this steel cable wrapped around the bottom of the tower for? The safety climb burned through at the 500-foot level. There was a hot spot on the tower.
Yeah.
And it came crashing down. And so we sent the tower crew up and to remove it. So they went up the other towers just to take a look. And tower 3 is the low-power tower with 10,000 watts. They didn't see anything going on with tower 3. But when they went to tower 2 up to the 500-foot level, it was hanging by a thread, too, at the same place.
Really? So
that's
okay.
That's what's happened out there. And you mentioned before how the tower is floating and it's hot and it's not at ground potential. My favorite thing is every year, of course, we go through insurance renewal and the insurance guys come out and they look at the transmitter site and the first thing out of their mouth is, well, how's the tower grounded? Well, it's not. Well, no. The tower has to be grounded. No, this is AM. We don't ground the towers. No. You have to have a ground on the tower. Tell you what, I'll give you a jumper cable. Let's see you ground the tower, and I'll stand back here. And when you come flying over, then I'll catch you.
Oh, man. That reminds me of the phone technician that comes out to fix your ISDN line and says, well, here's your problem. There's no dial tone on this line.
Yeah, it just goes tick, tick, tick. I don't understand.
I have never had an insurance agent say that, but that inspector say that, but that sure could be true because I'm sure it's in their mind. Hey, for lightning protection, this tower's got to be grounded. So
I explained the ball gaps and the curlicue that prevents the lightning from or at least slows down the lightning, and they kind of get that eventually, but.
We're waiting on Scott to get reconnected here. While that's going on, now there are some AM towers that are not grounded, And I'm not sure if we have covered this very much or not, but you know, to my knowledge, there's a series fed tower, which is also called a Marconi antenna, which is not grounded. It's series fed. That means that there's an insulator. The tower itself, the whole steel tower, sits on a piece of ceramic, and a big honking piece of ceramic, and all the weight is on this ceramic, which is very strong in compression mode. So that insulates the tower from ground. Now, ground is brought right up to underneath the ceramic. So they're, you know, ground in the tower. You know, ground is very, very ground right there. But there's a couple other modes. Let's see. There is a slant-fed antenna, which may not even be FCC-approved anymore, but I've seen some of these.
Well, the ones that are there are grandfathered, but if you make any changes, you do have to change the method of feed. They don't allow you to do a shunt-fed anymore.
A shunt-fed or a slant-wire feed? Because a shunt-fed...
Six of one, half a dozen of the other. The slant wire just happens to have this wire on a slant coming down, but it's still called a shunt-fed tower.
Huh, okay. Now, Tom, I've seen this a couple ways. Help me get the difference here. I've been at a station where there was actually a box some distance from the tower, at one station, even on the roof of the radio station, and there was a bowl insulator up there, and then a wire would go from the bowl insulator on a slant up to some point on the tower, which was a good matching point.
Right.
And so I call that a slant wire feed. I can't see how, I mean, there's got to be some distortion to the pattern there and some radiation pattern that, you know, may not be healthy or may not put the signal where you want to go, right?
Right, and that's why the FCC doesn't allow it anymore. It will produce a certain amount of skywave, and there's really no way to control it when you're using a wire like that. So that's why they don't allow it anymore. But it's a real cool tower, the Franklin.
Ah, okay, that's got insulators up in the middle somewhere.
And it's also insulated on the bottom, though the bottom of the tower is ground, and it's actually a half-wave dipole antenna. It's fed in the middle. They run a line up, and they feed it in the middle.
So the bottom, at the base, is there an insulator there at the base?
They put an insulator there, but it's actually at ground. They can bring a strap up and ground it, but the tower itself is fed in the middle.
The tower has either insulators in each of the three legs, or the legs come together to a point and there's an insulator, and they break back apart to into a tower again for the rest of the way up. Yeah.
Right. And of course, the big problem with one of those is that, let's take a look at WR at 710. The tower would be about a little over 700 feet for a half wave tower, for the half wave. But this is a half wave on the upper part and the bottom part. So now you're talking a 1,400-foot tower, and that's why people don't do these very much. And they exhibit kind of a narrow bandwidth. So,
well, and now the advantage to a Franklin, though, isn't it that you can adjust the relative, the phase of the signal being delivered to the top half and the bottom half, and you can then, I would assume, you can bend the signal down just a hair to hit the horizon good and hard. Is that right, or am I mistaken?
I haven't heard that one before. You probably could. But I think it would be very difficult to maintain because, let's face it, the phasing components, there's a lot. You'd have to have the phasing components on the ground to be able to do anything with them. That's an awful lot of transmission line to go from point A to point B and have everything remain nice and happy and healthy up at the connection point on the tower. So,
hey, in the chat room, it's being asked, what frequency is a 5/8 wave tower good for? And I'll answer the first half of this, and then maybe one of you can answer the second half. The answer is the frequency. Well, any frequency, from almost DC to almost light, a 5/8 wave antenna is a length of antenna that, when you compensate for the velocity of the steel, at the speed of light, you end up getting a 5/8 of a wave. It's more commonly used in the in AM broadcast. If you were to look at a drawing of a quarter wave AM tower, a quarter wave is just so standard. So we have the ground, we have the quarter wave tower standing on the ground, and then we excite the tower with the proper frequency that for which that tower is a quarter wave. We end up with a radiation pattern that is signal effectively leaving the tower in kind of kind of a heart shape if you lop off the bottom of the heart. In other words, there's a lobe that goes up at, I forget the angle, it looks like about a 45-degree angle, maybe a little bit more or less. But in other words, it's putting a lot of power up in the sky that way and a lot of power up in the sky that way. But it's also putting a pretty reasonable amount of power on the ground or toward the horizon. A 5/8 wave tower puts the most amount of power, these lobes actually turn down, and it puts the most amount of power onto the horizon. Now, you end up getting some little minor lobes of power going up to the sky. And when you get above 5/8 a wave, then things kind of collapse and you put a lot of power up in the sky and you don't get much power on the ground anymore. But 5/8 of a wave will take as much power as it possibly can and that you're putting into the tower and emit that out toward the horizon, which is where the listeners are, of course, and that'll amount in the most amount of signal on the ground. Sometimes the impedance of a 5/8 wave tower can be a little squirrely to deal with, so you have to know what you're doing with the matching components on the ground. I answered the whole thing. Hey, Mr. Tarr, you've been kind of quiet here. Let me bring you back in.
I think you know, to finish that or to add another angle to that question, the 5/8 wave is more practical when you get higher in frequency. And of course, the lower you get in frequency, the taller the tower needs to be, the longer the wavelength. So, generally, you wouldn't see a 5/8 wave tower at, a station on 540, 550. I mean, they exist, but it's not real practical because you're getting into really, really tall towers. But they are using 5/8 wave towers. They can be squirrely. When you try to match them up. So, but they are probably one of the more efficient antenna designs to be certain. You don't see a lot of them as you get lower in frequency. Normally you don't see those huge towers, in AM.
Thing you have to watch out for with the 5/8 are those little spurs you were talking about, Kirk, that go up. They do produce a little bit of sky waves, so it depends on the station, depends on the frequency, depends on the separation.
And then, as a matter of fact, I've got one of my towers in my array at night has a skirt that actually detunes the antenna because of that. It's actually a tower that floats at night, but it's so close to the other towers at that height with 5/8 wave that we actually had a very big problem with sky wave and shooting signals straight up into the air, that we actually had to detune that antenna to make it invisible, because that just added to that issue.
Chat room's asked another question that maybe Scott Feibusch can answer. Is Scott back with us? I believe he may be.
I'm here for the moment. We'll see how long my connection holds this time.
Hey, somebody in the chat room, Scott, asked how many stations, and I'm going to ask this in terms of percentage, how many AM stations use a single tower and they're non-directional versus how many stations are directional? Do you have any idea about that?
That's a good question. I mean, you have, for starters, all of those thousands of stations on what are called the graveyard channels, 1230, 1240, 1340, and so on. Those are, almost without exception, non-directional. And there are, I think, out of 5,000 AMs, I think there are probably 1,500 or so that fall into that category. Overall, then you add in all those daytimers and everything, I'd say there are probably about maybe 2,000, 2,500 directionals at most, but that's just a guess. I could run the numbers.
Well, my experience would be that it's certainly more than half are single tower. But I was an engineer in a lot of smaller towns where non-directional stations on those graveyard frequencies, as you call them, were much more common. I mean, the first station I worked at was 1340 AM, and at night, there's so many stations across the nation on 1340. We could sit in the car and see the tower several miles away and not hear the station. It was transmitting.
Speaking of directional arrays as opposed to single tower arrays, have you guys kind of heard I keep hearing, I don't know if it's rumblings or anything, but a lot of discussions lately about a movement to take some of those directional AMs, lower the power, and make them non-directional. A lot of these systems were designed back when it was imperative to get AM coverage in these areas and things. So you've got a lot of small towns with 5, 10, 20 kilowatt radio stations that are directional that really throw a lot of pattern over nothing. And I've started to hear some rumblings of some people investigating, especially now as you start to diplex AM systems, some stations there are thinking, considering dropping their power a little bit to, and then eliminate the directional array and still actually being able to cover their city of license by doing that. Have you guys kind of heard anything like that?
Oh, that's happening a lot, especially where you have a situation where a station might have decent non-directional day coverage. Say they could be 5,000 non-directional, and they're sitting on this huge piece of land so that they can have 3 or 4 or 5 towers for nighttime use. Well, these days the math is pretty easy in a smaller market. You sell off the land, and you just drop to the one tower, and okay, maybe you go down to 57 watts or 140 watts or whatever at night, but maybe you're simulcast on an FM now anyway. Maybe you have a translator going now anyway. All of a sudden, that big AM array isn't quite as important, perhaps, as it once used to be. And the odds are, if it was an array that was designed, let's say, back in the 40s, that the area that it's covering probably isn't necessarily where your population that you want to hit is now anyway.
In fact, Scott, I got to tell you, at a few AM stations, directionals that I have engineered at, we found that the population growth of a community is inversely proportional to the signal strength of the major lobe.
The AM that I work with here in Rochester, WXXI, which is unusual being a public radio station on AM, they bought a station that had been built in the 40s, and all the population in Rochester has gone out to the east and to the west, and our signal pretty much goes north and south. So, yeah.
In fact, there's a radio station in Greenville, Mississippi, and I'm going to send a link over to Burke, and maybe you can pop this up pretty fast. This is the call letters of WNIX, and this is a very typical situation. Greenville, Mississippi, is a town that is not growing. It used to be the third largest city in Mississippi, and I'm sure it's dropped down to sixth or seventh by now. So they have a WNIX as a 3-tower array. For I forget the license power at night. I guess I should have looked that up. Also, I want to say it's about 500 watts or so. It's just not worth it to maintain the towers and the directional array system, especially when it's hard to find engineering help in the area to maintain it. It's expensive to go take monitor points and keep things in. So the with some help from the people leasing the station, the ownership of the station is applying to make it just a single tower, non-directional at night, at a reduced power level. And the station is still going to hit something like 80 or 90% of the population that it hits now, because actually the major lobes cover, cotton fields. So there's just not
big
that
guys
much
do this. One of the Clear Channel AMs in Tallahassee just went non-directional.
That's
one of Charlie Wooten stations down there.
I think what helps is that the FCC has stopped requiring, certain classes like they did originally where, you were a 250, 100, 5,000, Now the FCC has kind of been very lenient about, oddball power levels just to fit a contour. And I think that helps that process along as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't monitoring. Burke, did you get a chance to, could you pop that graphic up there, Burke, that webpage? This is a website that is of a lot of interest to people interested in radio broadcasting. It's called radio-locator.com. Scott, you may have a site that's as good or better for this, but radiolocator.com will show you the predicted coverage area for both AM and FM radio stations. It'll also give you information about the station, the contact information, and if they're web streaming, there's some information there. The site has been around for a long, long time. But if you want to do some basic research as to where a transmitter is and what the coverage should be, there you go. This graphic you're looking at now shows the predicted nighttime coverage pattern for WNIX, and a 3-tower array is what produces that non-directional pattern that you see right there. So the idea is to actually get rid of two of the towers. A single tower would be left, and a more circular coverage pattern would be the result, but at a reduced power level, because the station still has to protect other stations that are probably in the direction of those nulls, the signal minima, has to protect stations that are in those directions from interference. So we're going to have to
including,
cut down.
Ironically enough, another 1330 in another Greenville.
Really?
South Carolina has a very old 1330 allotment there. What was WFBC back in the day, and now is that one has the WORD calls on it, or maybe it's WYRD. I forget which, but a lot of Greenvilles down there.
Scott, what are some websites that you like to do a little research on radio stations? Okay, aside from your own.
aside from several of my own, actually, because I also do the news editing for 100,000watts.com, and I edit the radiojournal.com. But another one that I use extensively is fccinfo.com, which is from the Cavell and Mertz, the engineering consultants. And all that it is, it's just a different front end on the FCC database. But it makes it a lot easier rather than going through trying to use the FCC's own AM query or FM query or TV query. You just pop what you need in there, and it can bring up Google Maps. They have an awesome Google Earth link, which is really, really neat. You just bring up Google Earth on there, and it's a link that you click, and it opens up Google Earth, and all the FCC data appears overlaid right on Google Earth. And so you can see things like STL paths, you can see tower heights, you can get a good sense of who's at what location, where STL paths might be shooting to. It's a nifty tool. It's free, too.
It is. We talked about this once before, because I remember after one of our episodes, I downloaded the little file. Was it a KMZ file or something for Google Earth?
That was one of my picks one week. I love that site.
Oh, okay. There you go. There you go. That is very cool. And the the database search is fast. I looked up WNIX AM, confirmed. Okay, it is half a kilowatt, 500 watts at night, and a kilowatt day in Greenville, Mississippi. So, but there you go. That's very cool. Scott, tell us a little bit about your 100,000-watt website. What is that about?
That is another directory. That actually, if you remember the old days of the M Street Journal, that evolved into what's now the Radio Journal, and it's now owned by the people who put out Inside Radio every day. We also do the continuation of the M Street Journal, which is now called the Radio Journal. It comes out every week. You can get a free email subscription, get it as a PDF, and it's a nice little update that comes out on Wednesdays about what the FCC has been up to and a little bit about what's happening in the world of broadcast engineering, and especially stuff like allocations, new station filings, that sort of thing. Then 100,000watts.com is a radio station database. It's paid access, and they really keep track. They've got a staff that does it that keeps track of things like station formats, group ownership, station websites. It keeps things a little more up to date sometimes than something like a radio locator, which is good on the technical details, but is occasionally outdated with formats. With 100,000 watts, we really try to stay up to date with formats and really try to keep track of exactly what's bubbling up out there around the country and keep that updated.
Tom asked Burke to bring up a graphic. This is a PDF. Burke, is that something you have ready at this point?
Well, what this is you had talked before, or you had mentioned before, about how the population kind of shifts in mm-hmm. some areas. And what this is the WOR pattern, the predicted pattern, the pattern filed with the commission. All it is the actual pattern. It's not overlaid over a map, but if you were to look at this and look towards the upper left-hand, towards the left and straight up corner, that's where our null is. Well, that is where northwestern New Jersey is, and where I am in Orange County. And the problem with that is when this pattern was put in, it actually started in 1936, and then was in 1967 when we moved to the Lyndhurst facility. This worked rather well because the area where I live in northwestern New Jersey, there wasn't much population. There were cows. Still are cows, but a lot less cows than there were. There are areas up in that northwest corner of New Jersey and up here around Orange County. I mean, you just can't, you couldn't put a house in here if you wanted to. There are too many. So, when we rebuilt the array, unfortunately, we're locked into this pattern because by putting that pattern together, it allowed a station in Niagara Falls, Canada, and we couldn't really push that out. And unfortunately, there's a significant population there that we really can't cover because of that, and that's mm-hmm. what happens when you have a directional array.
hard to predict the future from decades ago and project where people are going to move and live and how populations are going to change. Scott, you had a coverage map here of WXXI. Tell us what we're going to be looking at here. This is from the radiolocator.com website.
Yeah, this is us at night in Rochester. And what happened was our station started out as a commercial station called WSAY. And it was a graveyard. It was on the old 1210 channel, which shifted to 1240 in 1941. And then a guy named Gordon Brown, very, very talented, very oddball station owner, built a lot of stuff himself, managed to get what was first a three-tower and then a four-tower night pattern put in place in the late 40s and into the 50s. And put it south of Rochester to protect the stations that were on 1370 already in Toledo and in Manchester, New Hampshire. So the nulls kind of had to be where they were. And the other thing that happened with a lot of these stations is that until the rules changed, I think it was the late 80s when they changed, AM stations had to put 25 millivolts over the main post office of the city of license. So if you're dealing with 5,000 watts, there's only so far you can get from downtown and still put that amount of coverage over the middle of your downtown. So you're limited as far as how far out you can go. So you pretty much, if you're in Rochester and you're protecting stuff that's east of you and west of you, you got to go south because you got the lake to the north, which is what they did. And then those nulls ended up falling over what was farmland in the 40s and what is now thriving suburbia in the 21st century. And so we, like so many stations in that bind, have gone to FM simulcasting and looked into translators, because there's a lot of population that is just so deep in those nulls, and they are deep, deep nulls. You can drive west from downtown Rochester and you lose us inside of about 7-8 minutes at night.
Wow.
That's
amazing. Hey, we brought Scott on to tell a story about another station in Rochester taking a tower down. But first, we need to take a little break here and talk about our sponsor of the show, which this week is Axia Audio. And we're going to do that right now. We'll be right back with one more look at a coverage map, and then Scott Feibusch to talk about the dismantling of a big, big tower in Rochester.
Yes. I want to tell you about our sponsor, which is Axia Audio. Now, I work for Axia, and I own some radio stations, and I've had an opportunity to build literally dozens of non-Axia studios, you know, traditional studios, either analog or digital, or in some cases with a TDM type of router. And I've had a chance to build several Axia studios, both at trade shows and in my own radio stations and in some of Axia's customers around the world. I got to tell you, IP audio is a fantastic technology. It's flexible, which means you can do a lot of different things with it, things you didn't even know when you got it. It's powerful, it's cost-effective, and people said, though, it was too hard to configure the network switch or switches, because, yeah, it does take some command line operations with HP switches or with Cisco switches to get them properly configured for an IP audio network. So Axia went out and made it easy. They put a custom built-in pre-configured IP audio Ethernet switch inside the new PowerStation console system. There's no switch configuration. It is ready to go right out of the box. You can turn on the power. You can plug in your sources and plug in your speakers and your destinations. You can name those things in your browser. Just go in there with your browser. It's as easy as can be. And then you are ready to go. You don't really have to name them. You know, you could just use the default names. But if you want to name them like CD1, Mic1, CD2, Automation 1, 2, 3, 4, you do that. Watch the video about installing an Axia PowerStation console. It's on the AxiaAudio.com webpage. It's on the front page. Just go to AxiaAudio.com and you'll see two small videos there. You can watch them small size or blow them up bigger. And you'll see Rachel Bernard and me installing and configuring an Axia IP audio studio with PowerStation. There's no more punch blocks to mess with. There's no building up little ditty boxes to make a relay work, for example. No more messy and outdated documentation for your facility. Whether you're a little or a lot, whether you know a little or know a lot about IP audio, you can get an Axia console and PowerStation on the air literally in a few minutes. If it's your first time, it may take you a couple hours. But if you know what you're doing, literally a few minutes to get Axia up and running. Keeping up with friends on Facebook? Well, you can keep tabs on Axia and IP Audio there as well. Just click on the Facebook button on the Axia Audio homepage at axiaaudio.com. So whether you're a small facility with one studio, medium-sized groups with maybe 5 to 12 studios, or even a large to massive facilities with 50 studios and room to grow, Axia connects easily to legacy consoles and equipment. I want you to hear that. Axia connects easily to legacy consoles and equipment. You don't have to change your whole facility to IP audio. You can add it in as your budget and time allows. And Axia will grow as you do. So, there are over 2,000 Axia consoles on air around the world. Axia is the leader in IP audio, and now it's the easiest, too. Let me encourage you. Go to axiaaudio.com and find out about it for yourself. It's easy. Watch a video, like Axia on Facebook if you're active there, and check out the white papers, too, if you want to dig in a little bit deeper at axiaaudio.com.
And it's we're back on This Week in Radio Tech. We got one more quick map I want to show you because I'm just so proud of this map. You guys have trouble covering your population. This is my radio station. this is my radio station in American Samoa, and we do cover just fine.
Yeah, man.
Isn't that crazy?
You got mountains there, though.
Actually, we do. You know, this is the predicted coverage, which doesn't take into account the terrain data very much. And there actually may not exist terrain data, or maybe 3-minute terrain data instead of 30-second terrain data. So it looks like a nice big pie plate coverage area, when in fact, from the transmitter site on Mount Alava, which is where that transmitter site is in American Samoa. It overlooks the Pongo Harbor in Pongo Pongo, American Samoa. There's a big, huge mountain just 3 miles to the west called Matafao. And Matafao puts a big old shadow over the populated area, like where the golf course is and where the Costules store is on the southwestern portion of the island. So, yeah, the coverage map is not exactly accurate. But
that brings up one other caveat about those radio locator maps, which is that not only don't they show you necessarily what terrain is going to do to your signal, but they also don't show you what interfering stations might do to your signal. That's not a concern if you're in American Samoa and your closest co-channel is probably, 1,000 miles away, maybe?
The closest co-channel is probably in Hawaii, and it's about 2,200, 2,500 miles away.
There you go. Yeah. But it is something to keep in mind when you're dealing with, say, the crowded Northeast, for instance.
Sure.
Okay, hey, Kirk, so I have a question for you. Yeah. Do the fish out there in those outer areas, do the fish get PPM things to carry on themselves?
We're throwing a lot of signal
curious,
over.
Just curious.
and we're a real overhyped class C3. I mean, our transmitter there is a kilowatt, and yet we're a C3 because we're so overhyped there. Yeah, the transmitter is a kilowatt. Just hums right along.
You can be any class you want in a place like that. It doesn't really matter.
You can. Exactly. You absolutely can. Absolutely. Hey, we're going to run out of time before we get done here unless we get right to Scott. Scott, tell us about this tower site in Rochester. Oh, and Burke, there is a URL that Scott gave you early in our chat room. You have to scroll back and have a look at that. But this is on the Fibush.com site. Scott, what are you going to tell us about here that happened in Rochester?
This is another one of our stations that's part of the WXXI family. We have, in addition to the AM station, we've got a 24-hour classical FM station, and we've got a public TV station. And about 30 years ago or so, the public TV station, which had been side-mounted on someone else's tower on Pinnacle Hill, which is the 700-and-some-foot, not even really a mountain, rise of land that's right in the middle of the market, about a couple of miles from downtown. They built their own tower there, and they built it as a candelabra tower, crossbar on top, and two UHF TV antennas mounted on top of it. And they put those there for our TV station and for a new independent TV station that had just signed on. Well, lo and behold, those were analog TV antennas, and as of June of 2009, they were dead weight sitting up there on top of the tower, and there's some other stuff we want to do with the tower. I want to put a new FM antenna up there, and it was right at its limit as far as what wind loading it would take, and so it was time to take the big antennas down. And that is what happened over the weekend, in the cold, in the snow. A 400-foot crane came in, and over the course of a couple of nights, if you scroll down there, you'll see some of the pictures of it that are further down on the page there. The crane came in, the antennas came off, and the whole top of the tower is gone.
There you go. There's the pictures. Now, for why those was of this you work on done the at Miami night, video piece, Scott, was it all done at night?
Well, here's the story. It was mainly done at night because this is a multiple user site. If you look in the foreground of that picture on the upper right there, that's another TV tower that's got two other commercial TV stations on it. The NBC and the CBS station are right there. And the ABC station is just out of frame to the left. And, oddly enough, they weren't too enthusiastic about turning off their transmitters in the middle of prime time during sweeps for some reason. Go figure. I can't imagine.
Yeah, you don't want to do that during Wheel of Fortune or Oprah, that's for sure.
No, so it pretty much came down to, okay, here are the times when we can actually turn it off, which was from 12:35 on Sunday morning until about 6 o'clock on Sunday morning. And when you've got people working up there in close proximity to all that RF, you obviously aren't going to take chances. They were wearing RF suits up there, but you still don't want to take too many chances with exposure. And so you do it when it's convenient for the stations. And these guys, I give them a great deal of credit. In fact, one of the guys who was up there, this is one of the neat stories behind this. The tower was built by a guy named Fred Nutt, who's a local contractor. He mostly builds bridges. And he built this tower when it went up. I think it was 1979 when he built it. Well, he was there with his crew. It's his grandson now, I think, was the crew chief, taking the pieces down because he was the one who knew how they all came together in the first place. So he's out there at 3 in the morning with us in the cold and the snow. The guy's 93 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, 93.
God, I'd have been in bed. I'd have let somebody else handle that. But God bless him. He was there.
So, Scott, I'm sorry if you covered this, but review for me again. Let's look at those pictures, Burke. In the lower left-hand corner, there are two big things laying on the ground. Are those the UHF antennas that were taken off?
Those are the UHF TV antennas. They're slot antennas. I want to say they were dielectric antennas, but it was a long time ago, so don't hold me to that. But yeah, the one in the foreground there where the arrow is pointing to, that's our Channel 21 antenna. That thing is 68 feet long, was 68 feet long. The one behind it is the Channel 31 antenna. That was, I think, 59 feet long, if I'm not mistaken. And they actually, there's a flatbed. When I'm taking that picture, there's a flatbed trailer that I've got my back up to. And that very night, they cut them up, and they took a torch to them and sawed them in half, and off they went.
Now those antennas, Scott, those are bolted down at their base where they connect to the candelabra crossarm, and that's the only support they have? There's no guying on those antennas?
Nope, that's it. And that was part of the wind loading issue, obviously, is you got these things swaying around up there. They're bolted in, and it took the guys who were working up there a few hours to get the bolts out, especially our antenna had been down. It got hit by lightning in 02, and so it had been taken down once before. So those bolts were a little newer. The ones on the other antenna had been up there since 1979, and they actually send up, was kind of neat, they send up a generator on the crane. They just hoist it up on the crane, and they've got some sort of a jackhammer up there, essentially, that they take to the bolts to cut them out after the crane has already hooked on. There's a lift point about two-thirds of the way up the antenna. So a guy climbs the antenna, hooks the hook on there from the crane, and at that point, the crane is holding up the antenna, and then he can disconnect it at the base. You disconnect the transmission line, and the crane picks it up. And it took, it was only about 4 or 5 minutes for each one to swing it out of the way. You got to be careful because you got those other towers right there that you don't want to hit. And they brought it right down to ground level and set it down. It was beautiful. I'm going to get some video of this up on YouTube. I don't have it up quite yet, but I'll send you some links when I do. It'll be up by the time the podcast is ready, I hope. And, they just set it down literally on its end, upright, and then very gently a guy comes up behind it and just gently tips it down to ground, and there it is, down on the ground for the first time in 30 years.
Gee, money. So this tower was not so tall such that a crane could be erected on site to deal with these antennas. What if you have a tall tower site that with a candelabra on the top? Or what are your options then? Is it a gin pole, or is it helicopter, or what?
You could do it either way. We would probably have done a helicopter with this. It would have been easier. The problem with a helicopter is that this is also right in the middle of a populated area, and the town government kind of frowned on having a bunch of helicopters overhead at 3 in the morning for some reason. Go figure. Can't imagine why. And so no helicopter lifts for us for this one. But, yeah, you can certainly do a helicopter lift with it. There was the Discovery Channel, I think, had that special a few years ago where you saw them doing a lift like that. It was amazing. So the HD video of this one, I'm sure you guys saw this. The link went around everywhere of the helicopter bringing it in. Or the other option is you go with the gin pole and bring it down very carefully that way.
Wow, that is just amazing. So is the rest of the tower still there? That looked like it was supporting at least an FM antenna.
Oh yeah, the rest of the tower is still there. Our current DTV antenna is side mounted on one side of it, and eventually, hopefully next year, we'll get a top mounted DTV antenna to replace it. We've been having some issues with the terrain. We don't have a lot of terrain around Rochester, but we have just enough that, you know, that extra 60 feet of height would make a big difference. And we have actually two FMs on the tower. And there's one that's side-mounted. You saw those bays in the picture. There's another that's down lower right now, and that's going to be moving up. There's actually a seven-around panel antenna that's going to be going up, and that's what we needed the wind load capacity for, to be able to put that puppy up there. So that's why the old antennas had to come down. It's amazing the number of old analog TV antennas that are just still sitting out there because there's no good. I mean, it's expensive to take these things down, and if you don't have to, in a lot of cases, it's better just to have it up there as dead weight rather than take all the risks that are involved and the expenses that are involved in removing something like that.
Well, and if they're up there, they help hold the tower to the ground, which is the way it was designed, you know, to be.
I love it.
Gravity, it's a beautiful
thing. I love it.
You know, I would think that, Scott, I'm looking on the same webpage, and this is at fibush.com/nerw.html. A little farther down the page, you've got a blurb about your tower site calendar. And on the cover of your 2011 calendar, you can, if you've got one handy there, throw it up in front of the camera, Scott. You show a tower site that has multiple towers on the same hill or ridge. And, you know, I guess, except for our site in American Samoa, which has two towers, two self-supporters, but they're some distance from each other. You know, I guess I have been to some sites. There's one in Las Vegas, just to the east of Las Vegas, where there's a bunch of towers on a hillside, on a site. This has got to present some real special problems for equipment to operate there, especially if some towers are guide and some are self-supporting. You probably got a lot of stuff in the air there. This has got to require some care in manipulating anything, just putting up a new antenna somewhere.
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, just the coordination that's involved in a multi-user site, because, you know, as we know, the FCC takes issues of RF safety a lot more seriously than they ever used to. So one of the canonical examples was up on Mount Wilson. Once you talk about an area that's got a lot of towers in one place, Mount Wilson has about 20 towers all packed right in next to each other. And the FCC came up one day and started writing RF fines. Well, the problem with that is there's so many users up there that a lot of the stations that got hit with the fines weren't necessarily the 5-megawatt UHF TVs that were probably the major contributors to all the RF up there. So you got to work with the other stations that are up there. Coordinated outages are a big deal when somebody's got to do work just to get everybody else to lower power. But it's like that at any multi-user site. It's no different. You know, in New York City, when you got to do work on the Empire State Building, you do it at 3 in the morning because that's when everybody can afford to shut down. You don't do it at 5 in the afternoon.
Wow. Mm. So, Scott, we've talked about this Rochester project. Was there another project you wanted to mention on the show this evening?
There is another one. I actually need to check on the status of this because I don't know if it's actually happened yet. But the mighty WLW in Cincinnati, that massive 700-and-some-foot-tall Lonox Diamond Tower, if you go to my homepage, fibush.com, and go to the homepage, it's the picture right in the middle of the page there. Twin to the WSM Tower down in Nashville, built by the same crew over the same summer in 1932. For the first time since 1932, they are replacing the guy wires on that tower. Wow. And you can imagine what a project that is, because it's another one that has become surrounded by suburbia. And so, first of all, you know, if something happens to that tower, you're not going to get zoning permission to rebuild a tower like that. Second of all, you don't want the expense of having to rebuild a tower like that. And third of all, you have one layer of guys, so you don't even get the security of saying, okay, we'll work on this layer of guys while we take the other one off. You just got that one layer of guys in the middle, and that's all that's standing between you and the whole thing tipping and falling over and a 700-and-some-foot mass of steel. So it's nerve-wracking work. I would not want to be the one doing it.
What kind of insurance covers do you have for that? I mean, who comes out and checks on that? Who oversees who in saying, well, we're going to put a new guy wire parallel to the old guy wire and get it cranked up pretty well and then ease off the old guy wire while we ease in the new guy wire? That's got to be a real balancing act.
I believe it's the guys from ERI who are not far away from there down in southern Indiana. I mean, if anybody knows about tower stability and tower construction, those would probably be the guys to trust. It's a tricky thing to do. My understanding is that they're actually putting in new guys first and then removing the old ones. I think that's how they're going about it. But we've certainly seen accidents happen with guy wires. KFI in Los Angeles, which is featured in the back of my calendar this year each year. As you may know, I do the centerfold in the back with a vertical tower. And the vertical tower this year is KFI, the latest version of the KFI tower. This was the one that was hit by a plane 6 years ago, right before Christmas. They went to re-erect it, and one of the guy wire anchors failed when they had about a third of the tower up, and the partial tower, that's when it's most dangerous, when it's not fully stabilized, the partial tower collapsed because the guy wire anchor failed, and they had to go back and rebuild a much heavier duty guy anchor and really do it right the third time around, and so far it's holding.
I just found a website that I had forgotten about a long time ago. I'm going to put it in our chat here so that our private chat, and remind me to put it on the website. But it's Jim Hawkins, WLW website, and there are some good pictures there of the site. And I'm sure you have some too, Scott. Didn't mean to steal
finally,
your glory, but there's
no. It took me the longest time. Every time I would go down there, it would be either heavy clouds or rain, and I just couldn't get a good picture. Finally, this summer, I went down there, and it was raining. Sure enough, and then came back at the end of the day, and the clouds cleared, and the light was streaming down on it. It looked like the heavens were just shining on the thing. It was just, that is one amazing sight. That is really, if there's any site out there that ought to be a museum of high-power AM technology, that is the place right there.
I just sent Burke a link to a JPEG picture. This is a great angle on this guy wire for the WLW tower, and if Burke can pop that puppy up, it's going to look really neat. I'll put this in the show notes too, the Jim Hawkins site as well as Scott's site. This is looking up a guy wire right to the middle part of the WLW tower, and these Blaenox diamond shaped towers, you know, essentially they were a tower with a top with guy wires at the top, and then a self supporting tower on top of all that. So if you want to think about it mechanically that way, that's not a bad way to think about it. Ah, there we go. Burke, if you can zoom on that a little bit more, that would just be awesome. There's one of the guy wires, and I guess there are, what, 8 guy wires around the tower? That's what the WSM tower has.
4.
8. Oh, look, there's 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I think there's 8 of them around there.
Plus, they have the call letters on the tower. You got to love it.
Yeah, you know which tower it is, by golly. That's true. That is true. Hey, we're going to be out of time here shortly. Scott, tell us about this calendar for those of us, you know, who like to pin such things up and open the centerfold.
Would you believe this is the 10th year of it already?
Yeah, I'd believe that. Sure, I think I bet you 9 or 10 years ago.
I can't believe I've been doing it for 10 years. Whole new set of pictures from all over the country. There is even a Mexican image in here. I went to Tijuana and looked at towers. those are two of the TV stations that are up on Mount San Antonio above Tijuana. There is an image of this tower here in Rochester in the autumn of 2 years ago now. There's the candelabra there before it. There it is over there. Before they took it down. So it'll be obsolete by the time it hangs on the wall, but historical, the way I prefer to think of it. And they are available. They are shipping right now. $18 postpaid. We do bulk orders too. If people ever want to send something out as a holiday gift to colleagues or engineers, we do that too. But they're shipping right now from FiBush.com.
Cool. FiBush.com. You can order your calendar. You probably get it in time for Christmas if you hurry up and get there.
We got plenty of time. Unless you're sending it overseas, and we do sometimes. Yeah. But otherwise, you'll have it in hand in just a matter of days.
Well, that is so cool. And Scott, I'm happy to give you a chance to plug that calendar, because you're just full of good information, and your Northeast Radio Watch site is great, especially for those who live in the Northeast and are interested in radio. But no matter where you are, Scott always has interesting tower pictures and stories to go along with those radio station tower pictures and TV station tower pictures. It's a great site to have bookmarked on your browser. Fivebush.com, and from there you can get to
all things
Five. I'll
tell you what it is, the guys who maintain these sites and build them, they never get the appreciation they deserve. So if I can, since I don't have the engineering talent to go around and build them, I figure the least I can do is go around, take some nice pictures, and make the people who do build them look good.
Yep, very cool. And you've had some picture of our site in American Samoa, but I don't think you came out there. You trusted somebody else to take a picture.
Yeah, I think Larry sent me those pictures. I'd love to get out there. Don't get me wrong. I would love to get out and get some pictures in person. There are a couple areas that I figure I'm just not going to get to right away. Nome, Alaska was another one that I had contributed pictures. But most of what's up on my website, I've been to.
Most of those, Nome, Alaska, American Samoa, these are places it takes a long time to get there, and there's just not much to do once you get there. Yeah. But if you want to come to Samoa, we'll treat you to a fire and knife dance evening, and we'll do all the Samoan things you can possibly do.
Not a whole lot. You're on.
Okay. Hey, it's close to the end of the year. Getting close to the end of the year, and we have a prediction or two. Talking about this before the show, Chris Tarr, in the world of radio engineering and the radio business in general, what is your prediction, Mr. Prognosticator, for next year? You have some special insight, a special Chris Tarr crystal ball.
We're going to be replaced by computers in engineering. No, I actually, it's not an engineering prediction, I think, as much as a broadcast industry prediction. Now, my prediction, we'll see if this comes true, is I think we're going to see a lot of mom and pop and small group owners, sort of like regional group owners. I think we're going to see that start to explode next year. I think we're going to see consolidation kind of undo itself a little bit. I do. I've been kind of following a few of these companies, and there have been some big success stories of these smaller kind of regional broadcast companies that are private that did extremely well through the recession. And as you know, some of the larger broadcast companies didn't do so well. And I see some of these smaller and slightly larger kind of mid-sized companies, I see them kind of in the position to maybe start expanding a little bit.
Interesting. Is that a warning to Tom? Oh, well, no, you work for a big company, Chris. You work for Entercom. Now,
I do think
that the big companies are going to sell off some properties?
It depends. Like, a company like, Entercom's actually pretty, pretty stable. But I don't want to see this. I don't want to say that we're going to see anybody dissolve, but I think we're going to see some of the larger companies sell off some of their smaller stations. And there's a history of groups like Midwest Communications, a guy by the name of Duke Wright owns that, based out of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And, I don't want to say they're flush with cash or anything, but it's privately held and they do very well financially. Yeah. And, I think they're always looking. You look at the success my friend Mike has had, Mike and Carrie up in Door County, Wisconsin, with their standalone FM. They're doing exceptionally well. But I think the difference is all these operators are very locally, kind of locally based and do a lot of business locally and program locally. And I think that is it's working for them, and I think some people are going to start taking notice of that.
Interesting. And I too have heard a few success stories about locally owned or small group stations where an entrepreneur has decided, hey, I can do this radio thing better than either the group owner or the existing mom and pop owner, and I'm going to make an offer, get these stations maybe even at a big discount in the current economy. And make a go of it. And I do know of a few. Well, I work for Telos Omnia Axia, and I know that we've had some purchases from some such groups that are with some excited, turned on, motivated, hardworking entrepreneurs that want to make something of a local radio station and give it the local flavor that the people are asking for.
And I don't think, and I certainly don't think that we're going to see the demise of the large operators anytime soon. I mean, the large operators are doing their thing, and I think there's a place for them. But I think that you're going to see, especially in these kind of smaller and medium-sized markets, we're going to see, some of these larger companies that had holdings there possibly shed those to raise some funds And I think the opportunity is going to be there for some of these smaller operators to take that and run. And, the way that they're going to succeed doing that is to, bring the programming back a little more with a little more local flavor.
That's pretty interesting. Mr. Ray, Tom Ray, what, you have a prediction for next year?
Yes, I believe that my buddy Scrappy the Wonder Poodle here, who's decided to come sit with me on the show, he and I think that those of us in talk radio may end up having it a little bit easier in the next year, because I have a feeling that Howard Stern will join the FCC.
What? You mean
wouldn't that be wild?
You mean as an inspector or as a commissioner?
As a commissioner, come on now. To make the laws? Oh, come on. Wouldn't that be
cool? I could like the current administration if they would make Howard Stern an FCC commissioner. Wouldn't that be interesting? May you live in interesting times.
Exactly. Howard's father Howard's father was an engineer, wasn't he?
I don't know if he is or not, but he started. I've known Howard for quite a while. He started in becoming big in the Hartford, Connecticut market at WCCC, and we've bumped into each other every so often throughout our careers. He's actually a good guy.
Wow. Well, hey, my prediction is I'm gonna take a wimpy prediction. I predict that I'll be writing 2010 on checks until at least February. That's my prediction. Hey, Mr. Feibusch, what's your prediction for next year? You got anything going on?
I'm gonna go off town. I'm gonna say if we get Howard Stern as FCC commissioner, I think we got to get Randy Michaels to run the media bureau. And the funny thing is, with the engineering background that he has, he might actually do a decent job of it.
Oh man! One of my favorite
Randy Michaels stories.
Under 120% modulation, you get a fine.
One of my favorite Randy sayings. And I actually have it as a signature line on one of my email accounts. Is there's a video a long time ago of Randy at WLW in front of a transmitter and said, "The goal of the engineer is to make these needles here go as far to the right as possible." Love it.
That is awesome. Hey, guys, we got to wrap it to a close. I want to thank our sponsor, Axia, for sponsoring the show. And I want to thank Scott Feibusch for taking an hour and a half out of his family time here during Hanukkah to be with us. Scott, thank you very much for joining us, and I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. I want to thank my wife for keeping the kids over in the other room tonight, too.
And they are lovely kids. You must have an angel for a wife. Also with us is Chris Tarr from Muckwonago, Wisconsin. Chris, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Ray as well. Tom from New York, the Hudson Valley. Appreciate your participation. And hey, Fluffy the Wonder Poodle.
No, Scrappy the Wonder Poodle.
Isn't that what I said? I'm sorry.
No, you said Fluffy. And actually, he's a little too fluffy. He needs to go to the groomers. But, hey, always a pleasure to be here, Kirk, and always a lot of fun.
And people say, my hair is too fluffy. I need to go to the groomer, too. Thanks for being with us. We sure appreciate it. Burke, thank you for switching the show. And we'll see you guys next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This Week in Radio Tech is sponsored by Axia Audio. Axia, maker of the Axia Power Station. Yes, it's powerful. On the web at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.